found out, I will be talking about a diagnostic test determining the location of GEV emission powerful blazars. As we're all aware, there's an issue at hand where we don't know the site of, well, the site of the GEV emissions in blazars is not pinned down exactly. It could be located closer to the supermassive black hole than the broadline region, or farther from the supermassive black hole, which I'm going to refer to as outside the broadline region, or within the molecular core. And depending on where this emission site is located, it also affects what source of seed photons you're going to be that are going to be scattered into the jet. And out of these sources of seed photons, synchrotron photons, accretion disk photons, BLR photons, or torus photons, we're only going to be considering the BLR photons and the torus photons for reasons I'll describe now. We have to take into effect relativistic effects. Depending on the direction the photons enter the jet, the co-moving energy density is going to vary by different factors of gamma, Lorentz and factor. So for an isotropic photon field, U prime, not work. Oh, U prime goes with gamma squared. But for a photon field entering the blob from behind, the U prime is going to go with 1 over gamma squared. So this determines which photon field is going to be prevalent at different distances from the black hole. For the case of the emission site being located within the broadline region, we can see that the prevalent photon field is going to be the broadline photons. Whereas if we look at, for the case of the emission region being located outside the broadline region, the prominent photon field is the molecular torus. So for all intents and purposes, we're only considering these two sources. The broadline region photons are characterized by an epsilon naught of 10 to the negative 5, it's an MC squared unit. And the torus photons are characterized by an epsilon naught of 10 to the negative 7. This difference in energy between the broadline photons and the torus photons, this is a critical difference. This is really the crux of our argument. The difference in epsilon naught affects which energy regime the electron cooling takes place. And thus, it affects the energy dependence of the cooling time. This is really, like I said, the crux of our argument, is that there's a difference in the energy of the incoming photons depending on what the dominant photon field is. So we're proposing a model independent diagnostic utilizes the energy dependence of the electron cooling time scale to determine whether or not the GEV emission originates from inside the broadline region or outside the broadline region. So the cooling times, they have different time scales depending on whether or not you're in the Thompson regime or the Klein-Machine regime. The Thompson regime goes with gamma squared, where gamma is the electron Lorentz factor, and the deep Klein-Machine regime goes with log gamma. So here we have a plot of the electron cooling time as a function of electron Lorentz factor. I have the black solid line is the total cooling, and the dotted lines are the various components of the components that go into that total cooling. So we have the blue line being just pure quantum cooling. The green dotted line is a synchrotron cooling, and this red dotted line is cooling in the Klein-Machine regime. And as we think, we extend this backwards, the red line and blue line would connect. So, for the case of the emitting region being located within the broadline region, we see that in this energy band that I've highlighted, the cooling time is pretty much energy independent. Whereas in the same energy band, or the same band of electron Lorentz factors, the cooling time for the torus photon the electrons cooling on the molecular torus photon still have a heavy energy dependence. So because the emission is energy dependent, this energy independence in the cooling time for photons, for electrons cooling on broadline region photons, is going to be manifested in the light curves. So here we run a simulation where we do a simulated flare. And in the case of the emitting region being located, located inside the Brownian region, we see that the variations are achromatic. The K times have comparable time scales. Whereas if the emitting region is located outside the Brownian region, we see that the decay times of the flare are very heavily energy dependent. And this is our diagnostic. We can utilize the decay times of bright flares, because these are all visible from Fermi wave bands. I forgot to mention, we plotted these at 100 MeV, 1 GeV, and 10 GeV. So by looking at the decay times and looking to see if they're energy independent or not, we can say that, okay, this flare is located within the broadline region, but this flare originated from outside the broadline region. So something to consider, and this simulation here assumes a point source. We haven't taken into account light crossing effects. But here I have plotted the intensity over time for just an arbitrary source with the initial intensity normalized to 1 and the light crossing time normalized to 1. I have it plotted here for 3 different times, which really is 3 different energies. And this is assuming cooling in the Thompson regime, because that's where you expect to get the distinguishable cooling times or decay times. And in the Thompson machine, the cooling time goes as 1 over the square root of the energy. So by plotting the 3 different cooling times that are different by a factor of square root of 10, I'm really plotting it at 3 different energies that differ by a factor of 10. So the flare decay time, this flare decay time, is convolved with assuming a source that's decaying exponentially, and it convolves that with the light crossing time. And there is a noticeable difference in the cooling time at different energies, even when light travel time is included. So our diagnostic is not going to be hindered by taking into account light crossing time. The next question is, will these effects actually be observable within observational error? So we developed a very quick and dirty feasibility test. The test consisted that we took an example flare of everyone's favorite blazar, 3C454.3, the November 2010 flare. And we took the maximum fluxes from this flare at 100 MeV and 1 GeV, and we assumed an exponential decay. And then we took points at 6-hour time bins, and we applied the maximum error from the plot to each of those points. We're really looking at the worst case scenario. So this is log of the flux over time. And what we did then is we fit these points for the line, the slope of that line, the inverse of the slope of that line, being the electron cooling time, the characteristic cooling time. And even within error, even in the maximum error, worst case scenario, these cooling times are still distinguishable. So the next step would be to apply our diagnostic to 3C454.3. The rising time of this flare was in the collaboration paper, talk about this flare, they applied an exponential rising time and decay time to these different sub-flares. And they found a rising time for this flare to be about 4.5 hours. And they also found a characteristic decay time of 15 hours. So already we can see that the decay time is noticeably longer than the rising time. And the rising time really puts an upper limit on the light crossing time. So we're seeing a decay that's longer than the light crossing time. Therefore, we must be seeing radiative cooling and not just light crossing effects here. So if we look at this plot here, where the red is points at 100 MeV times a factor of 0.05, and the blue is at 1 GeV. But according to our diagnostic, the cooling time, the ratio of the cooling time at 100 MeV and 1 GeV should differ by a factor of square root of 10. And by visual inspection, it's really hard to tell whether or not these two cooling times do differ by a factor of square root of 10. So really, further analysis is needed. But what I were to say is, if we were to find that, yes, these decay times differ by a factor of square root of 10, that means we will be cooling in the Thompson regime, which would indicate that the flare originates from outside the broadline region. Whereas if the decay times of these flares were to be similar, then we would conclude that, okay, yes, according to our diagnostic, this flare is located within the broadline region. So in conclusion, we have a model-independent diagnostic that depends on the difference in photon energy between the broadline region and molecular torus photons. This difference in photon energy causes the cooling time, causes electron cooling to occur at different energy regimes, and therefore we'll see an associated energy dependence or independence in the light curve. We found that light crossing time effects are quantifiable, and they do not erase the energy dependence of the flares for the case of the region being located within the torus, outside the broadline region. And this method is feasible for bright Fermi flares. That would be it. Yeah, we factored into our simulation. We do have. No, we assumed the Doppler factor of a gamma of 10 for these. So we assume that the emitting region size is constrained by the variability time scale. So for the simulation, we assume the emission region size of 10 to 15 centimeters.
Okay. Chuck that out.
Yeah, we just didn't have much careful.
Can have geometric effects that like pancakes hitting each other, like we're jumping, and you have pancakes hitting each other at right along the line of sight, then they lose.
Make the assumption that you see that the bottom of the down button.
All right, maybe you guys need to resume offline. So thanks. We'll second round.